end of the season, or the driver, he would always call out where we are, where we had arrived, and say, "Lane Jos," you see, everyone knew where to get off. This was it. Now, those documents are very interesting. You may recall that many of the students involved in this episode carefully pieced together documents that have been shredded. And all of them are of high significance and importance. And I was able to get some of them at the time. Unfortunately, my house burned down by fire some time afterwards, but still I have some of those documents. The one which I treasure to this day and is important is a set of documents detailing the relationship of the Shah's regime with the abomination, the racist entity, the genocidal gang of criminals that we call Israel. In this document, this is a slim volume, you find accounts of visits to Tehran by Israeli generals, nicely received, and promises of military cooperation, exchange of intelligence, and this stuff. This is why, from the very outset, Iranian opposition, the opposition of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Zionism, has a long, deep history. And it is not only a matter of history, it is also, of course, a matter of present policy and present reality. And I would say immutable policy, immutable reality. We will come to that, inshallah, later. I have other reminiscences. I met the Imam in Qom again. The last time that I met him, unfortunately I can't remember right now the date. But he was in Jamaran, that suburb of North Tehran, where he stayed until the end of his blessed life. And on that occasion, precisely because of his weakness, I did not get to speak to him long. But he spoke to me briefly and said, "When you return to America, say one thing, that our people is an oppressed people. No, we're not in Macedonia. We are an oppressed people. Oppressed at that point, no longer by a tyrannical regime imposed, maintained by the United States, Israel, Britain, and other hoodlums, but oppressed because of the continuing, relentless hostility from the outside world." This brings me to another set of reminiscences. Again, not of broad significance, but for me, indelible and important memories. I recall in, I think it was 1990, I can't remember the exact date, I was in downtown Tehran, not far from Meydan-e Tuğlan. And nearby, an explosion of bomb had been set off at a bus stop outside one of the ministries. And on this occasion, it was the rush hour, a large number of people waiting for the bus. Something like 30 people had been killed as a result of this bomb. And they were brought into nearby morgue, and I saw those bodies. Still in the clothes in which they had died. Men, women, old men, women who had gone shopping, children on their way to school. But there they were, their lives cut short by a bomb placed by who knows who. Of course, a high possibility that this was already the group that calls itself, quite undeservedly, Salzmanim Mujahideen. Mujahid is a noble concept. A noble concept that is far above that which we may call the organization. The title given to them, official and popular usage in Iran, is of course Munafiqin. They're hypocrites. They're hypocrites insofar as they invoke the noble principle of jihad. And they have been continuously engaged, indeed, in terrorism and in assassination. I don't know the totals. But of course, there was some high visibility assassinations. The explosion that took place at the headquarters of the Islamic Republic Party, the assassinations of several Friday prayer leaders, and countless other individuals in Iran, whether military or civilian. interesting, among many other things, is that this organization, the Munafiqeen, was for long proscribed as a terrorist organization in Europe. However, on January the 27th of this year, the European Union decided that no, these people are not terrorists, despite their bloody record, and their assets ought to be released too. What I find interesting about this, here there's a diversion into contemporary or recent events. On that very same day that the Munafiqeen declared not a terrorist organization, should be given access to their assets from European banks, on that self same day, another representative of this European Union was aware he was in Gaza. And this senile, impudent hypocrite from the European Union had the shamelessness to say that Hamas is guilty of terrorism. There he was, in Gaza, surrounded by ruins and by mourning people, and he had the impertinence to declare that Hamas was guilty. And he said also, the European Union, well, we're tired of paying for you people. What was the amount on offer, by the way? It was something relatively small, you know, like $60 million. It didn't occur to him that the people of Gaza, the people of the Muslim world in general, are tired of seeing their men, their women, their children killed, slaughtered by invaders and aggressors and racists. It has to end. In any event, let me return to my reminiscences. I also was able, in later journeys, to visit not the front line, but close to the front line in the Jangi Tahrir, the war that was imposed on the ground. I went, for example, to Abadan and to Khorramshahr. Khorramshahr was, of course, a major port city in Khuzestan, close to the Iraqi frontier, and it had been occupied by the Iraqi forces. And I was able to go there soon after its liberation. What I found interesting, among many other things, was that the entirety of the city had been leveled with the ground. It reminded me, in fact, of the Israeli destruction of that city, the name of which I unfortunately forgot. Before they evacuated it and returned it to Syria, they also, bless their hearts, decided to destroy the whole city. That was the only near contemporary parallel that came to mind. The entire city had been destroyed. All that was left was a mosque. And please, do not think that this was for reasons of piety. No, it was used by the Iraqis, or better to say by the Iraqis, as a headquarters, as an administrative headquarters for the Sikh movements. Despite all of this, once the Iranian forces had approached the city, the Iraqis were so demoralized, was so lacking in any form of superior motivation that they lined up in massive numbers to surrender to an infinitely smaller Iranian force. If Iran was able to survive this abomination, this imposed war for so long, it was not because of superior military resources. On the contrary, we all know that Iraq was supplied with everything they wanted, by everyone in sight, Britain, France, Germany, America, the Soviet Union, and the military resources of Iran were extremely slight by comparison. The superiority of Iran lay precisely in morale and in devotion, and belief in the concept of martyr. May Allah bestow his blessings and the highest reward of all of the martyrs who fell. Whenever I go to Tehran, one of the first places to go is Peshtetakhar, where thousands upon thousands of martyrs of the revolution and of the war still lie. This, I would say, is a manifestation of the spirit of martyrdom, which is often misunderstood by Muslims, as if it was some kind of arbitrary suicide, a desire simply to die in a spectacular fashion. No, there is something else involved. Martyrdom is a form of victory. Martyrdom is a form of victory. And in this sense, the Muslim people of Iran have won massive and continuous victories. I remember also from that trip, that brief trip to Khuzestan, fairly near the front line, I spent one Thursday evening with a group of young volunteers, Basijis, who were preparing to go into battle the very next day. And these young men, who knows how many of them are still alive, who knows how many were martyred. How were they preparing to go into battle? You know, not by smoking cigarettes or getting on their cell phones. No, by engaging in the prayer that we have in Jesus, known as Dua Yakumi. This was their preparation for battle. Also, with respect to this war, I had the opportunity to meet in Tehran, in hospitals, with some of those who had been wounded by the chemical and biological weapons employed by the Ba'athist regime. And it is now time, I think, to speak in more detail about the American involvement and instigation of that war. The Imam said, I think at the very outset, that from the sleeve of Saddam we see emerging the hand of America. The Imam had this gift, among many other gifts, of summarizing in a concise and vivid fashion the reality of matters. And of course, the longer the war continued, the more visible and the more murderous became this hand. It cannot adequately be stressed that the United States' involvement in the war was crucial. In the first place, yes, it was the Arab satellites of the United States, the disgraceful regime of Saudi Arabia, and these pseudo-states that line the southern shore of the Persian Gulf, it was they that gave financial and political support. Let us also not forget to make dishonorable mention of Jordan, the so-called king of Jordan, King Hussein, who was the darling of the West. Part of what he did was also to fly to Baghdad on numerous occasions and embrace Saddam Hussein. And of course, among those embracing Saddam Hussein was Donald Rumsfeld. You know that he went twice to shake the hand of Saddam at a time when, let this be remembered, there were no diplomatic relations between the United States and Iraq. This did not prevent the United States from supplying directly the Ba'athist regime of Iraq with the ingredients needed for chemical and biological weapons. It is, to put it mildly, hypocritical of the United States when launching its war against its former hireling, Saddam Hussein, suddenly to say, oh, you know, this is terrible, the man has or has used chemical weapons. Yes, he did. When did he do them? Who gave him those weapons? And under whose protection did he use them? The United States here is fully guilty. Not exclusively, Britain also, Russia, France, Germany, all were involved to one degree or another, whether it be governments or private companies operating with the consent of the relevant governments. This is something that is utterly undeniable. Not only that, we know that, again, at a time when there were no diplomatic relations between the United States and Iraq, that military officers of the U.S. Air Force were stationed in Baghdad, and AWACS were flying in the Gulf in order to guide the Iraqis to the location of Iranian forces in order to use chemical weapons against them. What more can be said? This was indeed a war, a proxy war, of the United States against Iran already in that time. President Ahmadinejad has said very rightly, very justly, that the United States owes Iran an apology. Much earlier,